Hello, and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs. I'm joined with my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we have another episode focused on Endo Society update. So on the second day of the meeting, they released a new guideline called Pre-Existing Diabetes and Pregnancy, an Endocrine Society and European Society of Endocrinology Joint Clinical Practice Guideline. And this was simultaneously published, and it's very exciting. This is a guideline that's been in the works for, I think, at least 2 years or so. And there are several recommendations for those with pre-existing diabetes and pregnancy. This is an area that Natalie and I both work extensively in, and so we're very, very excited about it. There are 10 recommendations. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through them and we're going to talk about them. And just as a heads up, these are based on the GRADE evidence, so very high quality evidence, and really looking at what the research says, randomized controlled trials, and and they also provide kind of their evaluation. Is this expert opinion versus is this based on randomized controlled trial when making these recommendations? All right. So with that being said, what are the recommendations? All right, dun, dun, dun. So I'm going to share the first two, which aren't like super surprising, okay? So the first one is adult women with diabetes should be asked a screening question about pregnancy intention at every reproductive diabetes and primary care visit. I think that makes so much sense and is really not being done in practice all of the time. And so I think that's really important because a lot of pregnancies people unfortunately go into with elevated A1Cs and not at target, and that can lead to negative outcomes. So while this is very simple, I think that makes so much sense, and I hope to see this implemented. The second one is that women with diabetes should use contraception when pregnancy is not desired. That's also really straightforward. I think anyone should use contraception if pregnancy is not desired, but I think it's important. We need to remind people of that. And so that is recommendation two. All right. Next, things get a little bit spicier. Natalie, you want to introduce recommendation number three?
Absolutely. So interestingly, and maybe contra care that we're offering right now sometimes is that women should discontinue GLP-1 RAs before contraception rather than during the first trimester in individuals with type 2. So let's talk about that. We always discontinue an SGLT2 before contraception. Before conception, we say, we don't do this. If you're here, we go, this is what we're doing. But we have in our practice a lot of times, because the GLP-1s help with other things, they help with weight maintenance. They help dropping that glucose down, to say you can use it until we know you're pregnant. And this is saying, wait a minute, what is that actually doing? And what does that transition from a GLP-1 typically over to insulin do to that early pregnancy? So, when I read this, I was like, oh, I hadn't thought about it in that way. But I do believe that we could actually slowly titrate up insulin, slowly drop it down. But what is the general population? The recommendation has to be that we actually stop it before people get pregnant. And I understand that recommendation. So, interestingly enough, that is, the data was largely limited, right? So it's pharmacovigilance data, which found no difference in congenital abnormalities, spontaneous abortions, or large for gestation or small for gestation neonates in people exposed to GLP-1s during pregnancy and, versus the control. But due to the limitations of this data, right, it's all observational, and we're not going to do a double-blind randomized control trial. They have to make this recommendation for safety. So think about it, right? You pull someone off of a GLP-1 abruptly. What happens to glucose? It's going to go up. And what are we doing to fetal harm at that point? So it makes sense, but I think it is not something that we've been doing in the past.
Yeah, it's tough because we know when we stop it that glucose is going to rise, that often there's going to be weight gain. And these are not good things preparing for pregnancy. Also, through weight loss, often it helps it makes it easier to become pregnant. So it can be a barrier when we're discontinuing it, and we don't know how long it will take the person to become pregnant. So I think those are some of the real world challenges with it. But I do understand, I also understand this recommendation, because it's true. Like, you stop the agent and suddenly very quickly you have to come up with a plan, like, okay, how much insulin? How are we going to titrate this? And it would be better to be on a stable, kind of a stable regimen prior to pregnancy. I think it is very reassuring that a lot of pregnancies are unplanned and women are on GLP-1s. And so far, the safety data has been really good. In reading through the publication, they do talk about with liraglutide, so one of our older, slightly older GLP-1s, that there apparently out of 109 liraglutide-exposed pregnancies, there was an incidence of 29.4% spontaneous abortions and 8.3% incidence of congenital abnormalities. And 6 of the 9 cases could not rule out liraglutide exposure. So we don't know that it is because of liraglutide, but we don't know that it's not. And it's like, well, why take that risk if we don't have to? And so I think that, again, that's where the recommendation is coming from. Now, with semaglutide's package insert, it says to discontinue it 8 weeks prior to planning pregnancy. And that's because of its long half-life. And tirzepatide also has a long half-life. So these are kind of, these are things that are definitely going to be impacting us in the real world.
And I think the challenge with it all is what? Is that not all women get pregnant as soon as they start trying. So this could take someone up to a year and then they end up in reproductive, or reproductive health. You know, it doesn't happen right away for all women. So they could need to plan to be off the GLP-1 or GLP-1 GIP for more than a year. And then on top of that, a year of pregnancy, right? So this is a change. And but I do, once I read the guideline and the reasoning behind it, actually believe in it.
Definitely. All right, let's get to the next one. So the next one is that pregnant women with type 2 diabetes already on insulin should not routinely add metformin to their routine management plan. So this is, you know, metformin's been controversial over the years. In some countries, it still is the preferred treatment for gestational diabetes. I think there's conflicting data, and they reference several clinical trials where sometimes the use of metformin is associated with small for gestational age babies. There's also concern about what happens later in life in terms of predisposing the baby to obesity, to increased risk of type 2 diabetes. We need more data in terms of longer term follow-up. So a lot of our trials, you know, they may follow the babies for a year, maybe 2 years, but we don't have that, you know, several years later, that increased risk. In type 2 diabetes, I think this makes a lot of sense, because the rationale is that most of them are going to need insulin. If there was dysglycemia prior to pregnancy and then you're entering this super insulin resistant state, you're going to need insulin. And so it's kind of like, well, why expose to 2 medications if you don't have to? There's been a lot of interest in gestational diabetes for using more metformin because of the ease of use. I mean, it's a pill instead of an injection. But even in gestational diabetes, it's not clear that there's better outcomes, and many women still need insulin. So I think this, you know, this is not surprising. Also, they reference how metformin in the first trimester was generally pretty safe if someone's already been on it. But we worry about in that second and third trimester, more of it is crossing through to the baby. And so there are going to be those higher exposures in the second and the third trimester.
Yeah, I think you know, they did a really nice job of saying, this is what we're recommending. This is why this is right. This indirect evidence indicated metformin increased risk of being overweight between 7 and 9 years of age. And that's where, as you said, we need more data, right? We certainly don't want to expose a fetus to something that's going to cause problems, you know, so that it makes it easier for the mother to be pregnant if we don't have to, right? So we have to balance. Everything is a risk and a balance, right? But we need more data on this so that we know for sure.
Yeah. The next one I'm super excited about, but I realize it's your turn. So you tell us about it.
You get so excited and then you write. Yeah. So women with diabetes can either use a carbohydrate restricted diet, less than 175 grams per day, or usual diet, which would be greater than 175 grams per day during pregnancy. This is recommendation number 5. So that you think, okay, wait a minute. What are you saying?
What are you saying?
Right? What do you mean you could do more than that or less than that? It's the same exact number even. So that most indirect evidence didn't find benefits of actually limiting carbohydrate intake on the risk of large or small for gestational age babies, okay? And a secondary analysis called the ADAPT-IT trial that looked at 547 people found that greater than 191 grams of carb per day doubled the risk of poor glycemic management. So there's mixed evidence, right? So they said use either or, phrasing to reflect insufficient data. We just don't know yet to make a clear recommendation on carbs. But Dr. Barber, who presented this, pointed out that severe carbohydrate restriction, less than 100 grams a day, has been associated with actual neurotube defects. So we do not want to say to someone, eat all the meat and cheese and vegetables that you want, and you'll be fine and your glucoses will remain more stable. That is not okay either. So I think that's a big point of it. And again, we just need to know more. We need to learn more about this. We do know that the more carbs you eat at any given time makes glucose fluctuation more difficult, especially if you're having to use mealtime insulin, right? It's just harder to control with type 1 or even type 2, right? No matter what. So a lot of times in my, you know, you're working on getting pregnant, let's spread your carbs out throughout the day. And that's when we start with breakfast, a snack, lunch, a snack, add a protein to help protect those spikes. And we're sort of spreading those carbohydrates out. But I'm not a restrictor of carbohydrates during pregnancy. Diana, how do you feel about this?
So the reason why I'm happy about this recommendation, even though it's not very specific, is because ADA has long had in their guideline 175 grams or more.
Yes.
And they actually point out that the evidence for the 175 grams is really, it's kind of been calculated through this indirect way. And it's really, there isn't really evidence to say, oh, it needs to be 175 grams. And so I'm hoping this will say, okay, like we don't need to be recommending that. And I'll give you an example. Well, we actually have 2 pregnancy books at Cleveland Clinic, but one of them has notoriously had 175 grams because that's the guideline from ADA. And now we're talking about, we don't have to say you need to have 175 grams. We can offer a range that is probably at least 100 grams based on Dr. Barber's, evidence, but it doesn't need to necessarily be 175. And I think that is really important because it should be individualized based on someone's size, their needed weight gain throughout pregnancy, a lot of factors. And what I think is more important than the number of carbs is the quality of the carbohydrates. And, having the whole grains and the non-starchy vegetables and more fiber-rich foods. We also know, though, that some people have trouble accessing those foods. Some people eat very high processed. We should certainly work on having less of those high processed. But for someone coming in, eating 300 grams of highly processed foods, decreasing that amount, even if it's over 175 grams, is going to improve glycemia, right? So I think it needs to be individualized. And I feel that through this new guideline, we can at least say now, we can comfortably recommend closer to 100 grams for some people with diabetes. And that can be appropriate for some people a little bit on the lower end.
I absolutely agree. So if I start a pregnancy at 115 pounds and someone else starts a pregnancy at 225 pounds, you're recommending 175 grams for both of us at least. That doesn't really make sense, right? So this is actually saying, wait a minute, let's look at this differently. And where is the evidence? And again, a lot of these recommendations are saying, this is what we know right now, and we need to learn more. We really do. This is going to be important over time. You and I just interviewed Carol Levy, Dr. Levy, about their AID in pregnancy study that they're doing, right? Same idea. There are questions we don't know yet, and this is a huge jump in the right direction. So, okay, Diana, next directive here.
All right. So the next one is pregnant women with type 2 diabetes should use either CGM or BGM to self-monitor blood glucose. And I think this is good. I mean, granted, I'd love everyone with type 2 to just be able to use CGM. The evidence in type 2 diabetes is not anywhere near as robust as it is for type 1 diabetes, where we have the concept trial where it's clear that we should be using CGM and it's superior to BGM. I think the type 2 diabetes data has been a little bit more mixed. I am going to go into the next recommendation just because they're really very similar and in line with each other. And that is that standard pregnancy glucose targets should be used instead of a single 24-hour CGM target. So the CGM, you know, the time in range and pregnancy range is 63 to 140. And typically, like for type 1 diabetes, we aim for 70% or more in that range. But what they're saying here is that we should be focused on those kind of essentially those BGM targets, that fasting glucose less than 95, that 1 hour glucose less than 140, so 1 hour after a meal, and 2 hours after a meal less than 120, instead of just being focused on time in range. And I think that is important because the concern is that if you're just focused on time in range, maybe you could get 80, 90% time in range, but someone is averaging like 120, 130, you know, they're still in the range, but they're running higher. Their overnights are higher. And so I think that's important as we're utilizing CGM, especially in type 2 diabetes, that we're not losing sight, that we still want to monitor those specific fasting in 1 hour or 2 hour. And I think the companies are making strides to make this easier. I know, like, for example, in Dexcom Clarity, now you can mark off the fasting goal, or you can choose 1 hour or 2 hour so the person can mark that off. And so I think that helps to utilize CGM and still make sure that we are meeting these goals.
Absolutely. I think that that is all, you know, when we look at time and range for someone without pregnancy and we say 70% between 70 and 180, we certainly don't want someone running 175 the whole time, because they could be 100% in range and still not be where we want them, right? It's the same thing with pregnancy. We really need those overnight numbers and fasting glucose to be less than 95. So if we're only looking at time and range and we're at 135 all day and all night, that's still not where we want you, right? So that's where this is. We recognize that CGM is an important player in this, but we also recognize that those built-in targets in between need to be observed. And that's how we're making dosing decisions.
Yeah, I do want to also just add, they said in there kind of some of the technical remarks is that ideal glycemic ranges, CGM metrics, and percent time in range for individuals for type 2 may be different to those with type 1, but they didn't necessarily provide what those recommendations should be. So we're still...
Right. We just don't know you on that. Right? We know people with type 2 immediately when we look at time and range without diabetes. We say, can we push that number up if they're still making insulin, if they're still, right? The same with people who have type 2 diabetes with pregnancy. Can we, is greater than 70, but can we push it to greater than 80 or greater than 90% and without increasing that risk of hypoglycemia? And where are those actual numbers? There isn't enough data to make those decisions, but we absolutely push that as high as we can.
Yeah, there will be a guideline coming out later this year, hopefully, that is organized by Diatribe that should have a little bit more specifics on these time and range targets for type 2 diabetes and pregnancy.
Okay, so next one, hybrid closed loop should be used over insulin pumps with CGM or multiple daily insulin injections, MDI, with CGM. So what is that actually? So a hybrid closed loop or an automated insulin delivery system, if you get to pick, you need to pick the one that basically is going to look at that glucose data and increase or decrease insulin dosing based on that predictive next, you know, whether that's 30 minutes or an hour out, depending on the system that you're using, right? Dr. Corkoy cited direct evidence that showed hybrid closed loop use was associated with improvements in nocturnal glycemia, just like it is when people aren't pregnant, right? And reduce diabetes burden. So she did emphasize that management decisions should remain patient-driven. Again, we can never, ever, ever in our clinical practice, we might know something's better clinically. We know it's better. But if we're going to increase the burden and the person doesn't want anything touching their body and they don't want this, and you would do it if you were the person, you're not the person. The person is the next to you in front of you. And so every guideline says, what are we doing? How are we going to touch this? But, you know, we do use hybrid closed loops in, we have, you know, you and I have talked about this before. In Ohio, we do have CGM coverage for all Medicaid patients. And so people who have a pregnancy that needs mealtime insulin, we are using hybrid closed loops, even with Medicaid, with private pay, with, and we're getting really great outcomes. So we do offer them. But again, it needs to be person with diabetes choice.
Yeah, I'm actually a little surprised by the kind of like they should be used, just because, I mean, in the U.S., we don't even have pregnancy approved systems. So the CAM APS is the only system approved for use in pregnancy. And while it got approved by the FDA, it's not accessible. It doesn't have a pump partner. We don't have it available. So that's an issue. Interestingly, actually, hot off the press, MiniMed 780G just got the CE mark for pregnancy in Europe. So that's exciting. So now they have two systems that are approved for use in pregnancy. And of course, we have the 780G and we're waiting on the FDA to kind of see if they remove the pregnancy contraindication. But I think the questions I have is that the current systems make it pretty challenging to reach the pregnancy targets. So for example, Omnipod 5, iLet, like it's just, I mean, it would, right? Like iLet isn't it's certainly not designed for pregnancy. So I guess there has to be that nuance here. Like, are we going to transition someone to a different system that perhaps will be easier, even though it doesn't have approval? And if we're using a system like Omnipod 5, like what are the best strategies? Are we, you know, going to use a combination of hybrid closed loop and kind of use manual mode a little bit, or just use it and just try to correct around the clock to get it lower?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yep.
So I think that's where it's a little, I think a little bit challenging to kind of figure out how we're going to implement this in the real world. But I am glad that they're saying that, because that is what we're doing. I mean, we know that hybrid closed loop are the standard of care for type 1 diabetes. And therefore, those with type 1 diabetes coming into pregnancy are often on these systems, and they're not going to want to come off of the systems. So I think it's good we have a recommendation supporting this. We just need more real world application and guidance on how to do this.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. Okay, you're up next, Diana.
Oh, I'm up next. All right. Okay. So the next one is that delivery should be early based on risk assessment rather than expectant management. And so here it was emphasized that pre-existing diabetes is strongly associated with stillbirth. And risk factors also include type 2 diabetes, having obesity, especially with a BMI over 40, with other weight-related comorbidities. So while there's not direct evidence, individualized timing for delivery is recommended to balance fetal maturity with the maternal and neonatal risks. So what they're saying is that really trying to deliver in that by the end of that 38th week for most people, and potentially earlier, to reduce those potential risks versus just kind of waiting. I know a lot of people want to wait and have the baby naturally, but the risks may not be worth it. And so really that has to be individualized.
Yep. I think that is it, right? So, you know, people don't want their babies to end up in NICU. And when the earlier you deliver, the longer that stay will be in NICU. But if we can protect that baby, we have to. So I think that's what the real discussion is what is the risk? Where are we with that risk? Are you a smoker? Do you have serious obesity-related comorbidity? And even a BMI is greater than 35, not even approaching 40, right? With other comorbidities, we need to be looking at that earlier for the safety of that baby. So, yeah, that is, I think that is the hard part, is women want to say in the end, I did it. I went to term. I delivered and I went home the next day. And, you know, you don't have to be a superhero at this point, right? Diabetes is hard enough. I think this is well worded. And I think this is a great recommendation for all of us to continue to consider, you know, to reduce that mortality. So, and I'm going to do number 10.
Number 10.
Postpartum endocrine care, imagine, should be emphasized in addition to standard obstetric follow-up. Why? Because poor postpartum follow-up happens. And there is an increased risk of de novo, postpartum hypertension and lower breastfeeding rates in diabetes. So we need to look at glycemic support post-delivery. So when we have someone with type 2 diabetes, the type 2 diabetes doesn't go away. It's different than gestational, right? So now we need to look at, are you going to breastfeed? Are you not going to breastfeed? What are we going to do? What medications are safe to use right away? What about birth control? How is all of this going to work together? So we need to make sure that there is glycemic help after delivery. So data from hybrid closed loop postpartum studies supports benefits of glycemic stability and long-term outcomes during lactation and recovery. This makes sense, you guys. This is not something that you should go, I wonder. But I will tell you that we really struggle with that handoff. So we are working in our system on a program to help those women. Let's get you to the closest place. Let's get you to the person that would associate with you best. Let's keep you. What do we need to do? Because some people stay, you know, their lives have changed. They're not back to where they were when they started. We can't always use the same medications, or we don't want to for different reasons. So we need to follow these people, and we need to make sure that they're not slipping through the cracks like we know they are already. So this is a wonderful close to, okay, now you've delivered and things are starting to stabilize. Now what? Now we need to follow these people with diabetes, don't we? And really encourage that, okay, we can relax the goals a little bit, but how do we keep you in the diabetes, you know, time and range that we want you in while you now are a mom and raising children and doing that other side of you know, lactation.
Right. Plus, it's also preconception planning for the next one,
yes,
as well.
Exactly.
So, I can't emphasize enough the importance of this. And many people come into pregnancy, they're not already following up with endocrinology, especially if they're type 2 diabetes, because they may have been followed by their primary care provider. Also, we are catching new type 2 diabetes in early pregnancy. That first A1C comes back, it's elevated, and it's like, oh, you actually had pre-existing type 2 diabetes. So, of course, they didn't have an endocrinologist prior. One of the ways we're addressing this is we have a diabetes and pregnancy clinic. We have a collaboration with maternal fetal medicine and endocrinology. And so we are seeing the patients collaboratively in this clinic. And we are ensuring that they have endocrinology follow-up, because the thing is, maternal fetal medicine, they're following them through the pregnancy and maybe one postpartum visit, and that's it. And so we have to have a warm handoff, and we really need to think about these collaborations and this team-based care to ensure the best outcomes.
Absolutely. So what are we missing still? What is what urgent research and clinical focus do we need to focus on? So improving awareness and uptake of preconception care. You know, I think all of us need to do a better job. You are this age. What are we doing? When do you, you know, are you ready? What would those pregnancy, you know, when I start talking about that, I will pull up their CGM if they have one and change it to the pregnancy targets and say, this is where we are. And this is where you need to be with pregnancy. Do you want to get there? Are you ready to do that? Starting that conversation sometimes a year or two in advance. When you're thinking about conception, you need to let me know so that we can have a special conception meeting and start talking about those things now so that your body is ready and you are ready, right? You know, what is your A1C goal? What is all of those things, right? And then what do we do? Do we want to look at the GLP-1 use and metformin's use? Looking at nutritional guidance, these things, we all need more research on this in order to improve outcomes for women and their pregnancies and their babies.
Definitely. And I think one of the things they highlighted is that evidence is growing But many of these recommendations are based on indirect data, and they highlighted that there is a critical need for more randomized control trials and implementation strategies to really optimize the outcomes in this population. So we hope you all will check out this new publication that is available. We will make sure that we provide a link to it. It was published in the Endocrine Society Journal, the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. So go ahead and check that out. And we thank you so much for tuning into this episode. And that wraps up Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives.